Yesterday afternoon, I had the opportunity to sit down with someone who's been called the best and most important writer of his generation, Ta-Nehisi Coates. He's national correspondent at The Atlantic, where he writes about culture, politics, and social issues. And you probably saw his cover story last year that exploded across the country called The Case for Reparations. He's also the author of the memoir, The Beautiful Struggle. And his new book, A Letter to His Son Samori, is called Between the World and Me. Ta-Nehisi, welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. Good to have you with us.
Mark, thank you so much. So glad to be back.
So where to begin with this? I mean, I know this is a letter to your son, Samori. But as I was thinking about it just a few minutes ago, this book is like a letter to your son, Samori, about some very deep things about America and what it means to survive in a black body. But it also seems to me you're writing, whether intended or not, to America itself, to face up to itself.
Well, if that is what people take from it, that's fine. I'm not opposed to that. I have to be honest, even the letter format was pretty much a literary device to help me write, because most of what is in that book is not going to be good for Samori at all. We've been talking about this for years, literally since he could, really understand, language. So nothing in there is particularly new for him, but it was a literary device to help me get focused and get out what I wanted to say. I wrote a piece about a year ago. I published a piece about a year ago called The Case for Reparations. And when I finished that piece, I was, when I finished the writing portion of it, I was somewhat dissatisfied because it only conveyed the experience in cold, really economic terms, which is sometimes what you need. But I was very much interested in exploring it from, the emotional perspective, from the literary perspective. And that was really what I was trying to do with the book. If the broader country come in there, I'm happy to hear that. It wasn't quite on my mind when I was writing it, but I'll take it.
Yeah, and I think that especially when a broader audience really reads it, and you can see it's up on the Amazon bestsellers list and more at the moment, that I think that it'd be one of those things that makes people wrestle. At least I hope it does.
Right.
I really hope it does.
Right.
One of the early pieces in the book, and you can read some of the passage if you like. I'm just going to read this one to you right now, but I have the tons of stuff I picked out. I don't want to make you do too much reading, but you write about this way you approach life. In some ways, this is almost like an existential form of introing us to what you're about to do to us in this book. Talk about your parent, your parents never tried to console me with ideas of afterlife, and were skeptical of preordained American glory. In accepting both the chaos of history and the fact of my total end, I was truly free to truly consider how I wish to live. Specifically, how do I live free in this black body?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because a lot of that I got from Malcolm X.
Yeah, right.
A great deal of that, not just my parents, but certainly from, and the immediacy with which he spoke. I always I think about this, that line. I think I quote this in the book, in Message to the Grassroots, where he's, critiquing nonviolence. And he says, don't give up your life. No, preserve your life. And if you got to give it up, make it even Steven. And I think, when people hear that, they hear this kind of, bluster and braggadocio. But to me, I heard, a beautiful, beautiful statement. Yourself, your body, is the best thing you got going. You know what I mean? That ultimately, it's the only thing you've got going. It's the best of you, and that was such a beautiful, beautiful, profound statement because it was an assertion about the beauty of the African American body. That's what I heard in that. I did not hear just somebody say, "Hey, it's cool to go upside people's heads," but this is the most our beauty, our hands, our arms, our noses, our lips, our brains are the most beautiful thing that we have going for ourselves. And they must be protected by all means. They must be protected. That, declaration of love, the kind of declaration a parent might make on behalf of a child, a wife on behalf of a husband on behalf of a wife, was it was bone-rattling for me.
It is, and it weaves its way through the entire book. I mean, there are two words, there's a lot of words, three words that really stick out in this book for me all the way through. One is the dreamers. The other is the concept of fear, and the other is the concept of the struggle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they're so deeply intertwined. I like to talk about that for a minute, just this whole, how they are intertwined and what they really are. I mean, when you talk about the larger world here, which you say the people who think they're white, this whole notion of white that was created in this world, but your notion of the dreamers is a really fascinating way to put it.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I wanted to do, I found myself writing the book, and I felt like I was using vocabulary that actually, like, you know, an early address is white people, white people, white people. And
right,
I felt
right.
like the vocabulary actually contradicted the point I was trying to make, you know, that I couldn't use that vocabulary. I found myself searching for handles and searching for ways to discuss what I meant. And the first thing I found was in this essay James Baldwin has on being white and other lies. And he has this riff at the end. And, you know, this is quoted in the book, actually, where he says, you know, they've endangered the entire world because they think they are white, not because they're white people, not because they have blonde hair, not because they have blue eyes, not because they have fair skin, because they think that makes them white, that constitutes something of real meaning. This is a notion that endangers the world. The notion does. The notion does. Not the fact of anybody's, you know, sort of physical appearance, but the need to assign qualities, the belief that the physical appearance says anything at all about the deeper person is an idea, an ideology that ultimately, you know, endangers the world. And I thought that was so, so fascinating, because what Baldwin was doing was refusing to respect names that had been put on people. You know, and then as I thought about, you know, more about that, about what constitutes that, what happens when you believe yourself to be white, and part of what goes into that is a belief in innocence, the belief that, you know, everything that you've earned, every, you know, place that you live, that, you know, the nice suburb that you live in, that Mount Washington in Baltimore, that Roland Park in Baltimore, that all of these sort of, you know, nice places within the city are somehow not tied. The bad places in the city. Somehow that there's no sort of connection between, I guess it's gone now, but Murphy Homes, you know what I
right.
mean, for folks that remember that,
right.
you know, and Roland Park, you know, but my argument is that there, in fact, is a connection, that there really, really is a connection. And so one, in order to believe that, one has to, you know, put oneself asleep. One can't be, you know, walking through the world as a conscious person, you know, in order to believe that. And so the dream is the opposite of consciousness. It's an opposite of an awareness of the world around you. And so I was really, really interested in teasing that out, and how that need to be unconscious actually endangers other people's lives.
So, like, the dreamers really are, it's the myth of the American dream, but it's also the people living in a dream that's not real. That wouldn't even
have been. Yeah. And you know what? I mean, it's been interpreted that way as dreamers, me, you know, directly referring the American dream, but I wasn't really. I really, really wasn't. I mean, if it's interpreted that way, that's fine. If people feel like that's part of it, that's fine. But really, I was thinking of this idea, you know, in the community. I mean, I thought a lot about, you know, the terms under which, like, even the vocabulary that folks use that I was raised under, and I, you know, thought about this a lot in my last book. But this idea, you know, of being conscious, which is something people used to say when I was a kid. Oh, is he conscious? Is she conscious? Are they really conscious?
Uh-huh.
You know, sort of this notion that you throw around, but when you think about it, it's actually quite profound. Do you know what I mean? The idea that if you are not politically aware, if you are not studying the politics around you, if you're not studying power around you, you actually are not awake. You actually, you know, have no ability to really perceive the world as somebody whose senses are fully aware. And so I was trying to think, okay, what is the opposite of being conscious? You know, well, some might say, you know, being dead, or some might say, you know, being asleep. But see, like that's not quite it, because folks think that they're aware. Folks are sensing things. They are seeing things. They are, you know, sort of, you know, having sensations. Okay, so what is that? Well, that is, you know, being in a dream, where you are, in fact, you know, not quite conscious. You know what I mean? Not really, really conscious of but conscious of something else, conscious of things that are not actually around you, that are not actually there, conscious of illusions that are really ultimately in your own head, like being white, that
right.
ultimately aren't real.
And that's juxtaposed against the reality that the dream wouldn't exist unless it was on the backs of human beings who people call black.
Right. That's exactly it.
Right.
That is exactly it. That is. Yeah. You said it better than I did.
So, I mean, that's why I think this. That's why I said earlier the book is clearly for a lot of young people, for people to read, but it's also for the nation to kind of wrestle with the stuff that we don't want to wrestle with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you write about, or later in the book, about the Civil War, the Civil War being the kind of fake innocence The exact words. Let me just get this real fast. It was on page 107. When you say the lie of the Civil War is a lie of innocence, is the dream, the reunion of white America in the years after the Civil War. I mean that's part of what you're confronting, to me in the book anyway, is that we have to confront this fabricated innocence.
Right. No, and that's it. I mean, you know, you have a war in which 600,000-700,000 people are killed. There's enslavement at the beginning of the war, and then after the war, there's technically not enslavement. And there are people who, you know, even today, run around and say, well, the two had nothing to do with each other. You know, you understand, you know, if you study it, that, you know, the bodies of 4 million African-Americans who were enslaved in this country, who are the majority of people living in Mississippi, the majority of people living in South Carolina, half the people living in Louisiana, Alabama, Georgia, that these people taken collectively constituted the greatest source of wealth in this country, more than, you know, all the other sources of wealth combined. And you understand that a mass of people died in a war, and that, you know, source of wealth was effectively liquidated. It takes, you know, one has to put oneself within a dream to believe that one is not related to the other. You know, that you have to believe in your own innocence to reject the evidence that's right in front of your eyes. You know, it is as if one had a need to believe that the world was flat. No different.
Right.
No different. And so, you know, and in that way, you know, one becomes innocent. You know, that's what the dream gives you. It gives you your innocence. You know, your belief that I did nothing. I did nothing wrong. Just some good old boys, you know, never meaning no harm. You know, that is the essence of the dream. It doesn't stop there, but that's probably the most spectacular example.
No, and then I think that this is the piece that Americans at least have to really kind of also look at as well. I mean, you obviously, as you wrote, love research and love studying. So you pull this stuff out, like the Mississippi Constitution when they broke away from the United States of America. And you have this great quote in here that just says it. It says, these products are peculiar to the climate verging on the tropical regions. And by imperious law of nature, none but the black race can bear exposure to the tropical sun. These products have become necessities of the world. And a blow to slavery is a blow to commerce and civilization.
It's right there. I mean, that's the Declaration of Secession, and that's the reason Mississippi gave for starting the Civil War. I mean, it's right there. This is not, and that's the thing about, again, you know, going back to this idea of the truth, it's not hard to find. You know what I mean? Like, if you want out, if you really, really want to get out, if you really, really want to be conscious. Now, the struggle, you know, of being conscious is constant. But leaving that dream, I mean, it's not hard. The evidence is right there. One must be making some sort of effort to clothe oneself in illusion. Because it really is right there, you know, to you know, believe, again, going back to the Civil War example, wasn't about slavery, requires effort.
Right. And I think that's, you know, when you look at that, I mean, the concept of dreamers is, I think, something that you'll put inside the American vocabulary, which I think is important for us to have.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other part of this is what you're saying to Samori and all the Samoris of the world. Mm-hmm. Male and female, which is that you may not have a victory, but struggle is really all I have for you, is what you say in one line, right?
Yeah, that's it. That's all I have for you. That's exactly it. It is right. All I have for you. You know, I don't have strawberry shortcake. I don't have chocolate cupcake. I have struggle. I have the hard reality of life. And see, if you can get that, you'll see that there's a great beauty in that. Okay, the struggle in and of itself is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And that was, you know, like I, you know, sometimes you say, well, it's not, you know, it's not a hopeful book. It's not, you know, it's a very, very pessimistic book. I mean, you know, I don't necessarily share that assessment. You know, I think, you know, it is pessimistic or it lacks hope if you believe, you know, that somebody's going to give you a cookie at the end of the day. If that's your, you know, belief system. You know, if you stand blind to the generations of black folks who for 250 years, you know, struggled to end enslavement, if you stay blind to the generations of women in this country who, you know, believe that women should have the right to vote, and yet these folks died in the midst of their struggle and did not see the fruits. If you believe that their lives were worthless, if you believe that their lives were failures, well, then this book is dark and pessimistic and hopeless for you. But if you believe that they lived noble lives, if you believe that people who struggle on behalf of things, whether they get to see, you know, the fruits of their labor in their lifetime or not, live the noble lives, then there's something beautiful in this book for you.
But because there's so much, I mean, I could pull out a dozen quotes here, but we don't have time for that. But there's a few in here that when you were describing just now what that was, and to also your love of history,
mm-hmm.
but what history says, you have this great quote where you write about the wisdom is not unique to our people, but then a few sentences down you begin, slavery is not an undefinable mass of flesh. You see that part?
Slavery is not an indefinable mass of flesh. It is a particular, specific, enslaved woman whose mind is as active as your own, whose range of feeling is as vast as your own, who prefers the way the light falls in one particular spot in the woods, who enjoys fishing where the water eddies in a nearby stream, who loves her mother in her own complicated way, thinks her sister talks too loud, has a favorite cousin, a favorite season, who excels at dressmaking and knows inside herself that she is as intelligent and as capable as anyone. Slavery is the same woman born in a world that loudly proclaims its love of freedom and inscribes this love in its essential text, a world in which these same professors hold this woman a slave, hold her mother a slave, her father a slave, her daughter a slave. And when this woman peers back into the generations, all she sees is the enslaved. She can hope for more. She can imagine some future for her grandchildren. But when she dies, the world, which is really the only world she can ever know, ends. For this woman, enslavement is not a parable. It is damnation. It is the never-ending night. And the length of that night is most of our history. Never forget that we were enslaved in this country longer than we have been free. Never forget that for 250 years, black people were born into chains, whole generations, followed by more generations who knew nothing but chains.
I mean, that is something for Samori and all of us.
Right.
You know, I mean.
Right. I mean, what I want people to get is, like, you know, the struggle's wrong. The struggle's wrong, man.
Right.
You know, and your lifetime cannot, you know, measure the length of any, you know, worthwhile struggle.
And so one of the other undercurrent themes in here, dreamers and struggle, is also the question of fear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you talked about that a little bit in your other book, but you really kind of delved into the heart of it here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, it's just the idea that when people are in power choose not to be aware and choose not to be conscious, that this endangers us all. You know, and so if you are ignorant of the housing policies of a city like Baltimore, Maryland, and you don't understand why, you know, neighborhoods look the way they do, this endangers us all. This subjects us all to great trauma because there are people who have to live in those neighborhoods. And when those neighborhoods are circumscribed in such a way, you know, as they were, you know, for many years in Baltimore and the other cities, when they're circumscribed in such a way so that, you know, the people who live there are discriminated against in multiple levels, on multiple vectors. I'm talking about jobs, education, housing, and poverty, you know, is enforced in those areas. Well, that endangers us. That endangers the people who live there, you know, because you have a group of people who don't have the same opportunities as everyone else, even as they see the entire world laid out before them and see other people who live other places having accessibility, having access to that world in a way that they don't. Well, I mean, people who wonder why there's more crime in those areas, you know, once you do the science, it's not amazing at all. You know, it's not shocking. When you are dealing with a group of people who have been, by policy, deprived across multiple levels, who are still being deprived today, this very day, by the criminal justice system, and you segregate those people and put them around each other, bad things happen. And so for folks, you know, who dream of, you know, something more, you know, who like to think about, you know, one day, you know, living, you know, somewhere else, seeing the world, seeing other things, or just want to feel some amount of safety in their bodies, the result of that is fear. They fear the very neighborhoods in which they live. And, you know, we have this discussion as though, you know, the crime or violence that happens within those neighborhoods is somehow separate. By which I mean the neighbor-on-neighbor violence in those neighborhoods is somehow separate from the same violence from the violence that is brought in by the police. And my argument that I've made in this book and that I make all the time is that they are not separate. It's the same thing. They're both policy-based. You know, it doesn't matter if you organize a chessboard in such a way that, you know, a certain move, you know, is guaranteed to happen or is more likely to happen, or if, you know, you just come and you do the violence yourself. You know, in both cases, you've done something to endanger folks, either directly or indirectly.
There's so much here that I would like to get to. Let me this piece here that you have given us about the weight of the dream.
Mm-hmm.
Can I just read this to you as we can talk about it for a
sure.
minute?
Sure.
You wrote, I knew that I wasn't so much bound to a biological race as to a group of people, and these people were not black because of any uniform color or any uniform physical feature. They were bound because they suffered under the weight of the dream. They were bound by all the beautiful things, all the language and mannerisms, all food and music, all the literature and philosophy, all the common language that they fashioned like diamonds under the weight of the dream.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, I think that's like, I mean, obviously the biggest example of that is African-American music, you know, which is, you know, cannot, you know, be divorced from the legacy of racism and white supremacy, which is fashioned under the weight of that. You know, and it's, you know, it's kind of a beautiful thing how that becomes, you know, you make, you know, as they say, lemonade out of lemons. You know, you make a culture out of that. You make a culture out of that way. You make music, you make art out of that. And that binds folks together, you know, in a way they become almost independent, you know, of the force. I mean, that's part of the beauty, I think, that's in the book. And, you know, some of the beauty, you know, that I see in black folks.
Now, and I think that's an important piece of the story, which is why I wanted to read that piece. And we can't get away without at least spending some time. You spent a lot of time at this when you spoke at Union Baptist last week, and in inaugurating your book to the public at the Union Baptist Church here in Baltimore. And you read the piece about Prince Jones, your friend who was murdered by the police, and visiting his mom. And I read that. I heard you read it. And I reread it again over the weekend as I was finishing the book over the weekend. And first thing I thought, I just got to share this if you don't mind. I started crying reading it, thinking about I had my Prince Jones in 1970, who was killed by the FBI and the police. It was he was my brother who was close to the Panthers. His name was Henry Kellum. And my first daughter, Chelsea, carries his name in the middle of her name.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had to do something not to let him just go.
Right.
The Prince Jones thing is so, it's just been, you know, we have these video things and we take these pictures so everybody sees the stuff now, but it's always been here.
It's always been. It's old. There's no new wave of police violence or anything like that. It's old. It's very, very old. And not only is it old, it is the predictable outcome of the policies that we have in this country. You know, I can't help but think about, you know, Freddie Gray. And if you make a decision to designate an area, a place, you know, of high drug traffic and thus somehow dangerous, you know, to the order, to the laws or however you want to call it. And then you send our police in there. And as part of that policy, you say, because someone looks at somebody a certain way and decides to run, that they can be arrested, a policy that you would never have on the Upper East Side here in New York where I live.
Right.
You have then endangered people's lives. I mean, you have then, you know, guaranteed that there will be Freddie Grays. They just will be. That's the natural outcome because, you know, the police are hammers. That's what they do. They're not drug counselors. You know, they carry guns. I mean, that's what they do. They are, the force of the state. And so when you have policy like that, you know what I mean, you bring police in like that, you guarantee that eventually you will have a Freddie Gray. And so, you know, with you know, as was the case with Prince, you know, and as was the case anytime, you know, this sort of violence happened, you know, the wanton reason, you know, the wanton logic, which says we greet all of our social problems with hammers, with people with guns. That's our response to, say, a public health crisis around drugs, for instance. That's our response to mental health issues. That's our response to child support in the case of Walter Skies, sending the people with the hammer. Well, I mean, this is what happens. This is what's going to happen.
And that's the basis, that's part of the basis for the fear.
Yeah.
Of everyday existence.
Yes. Because, you know, parents who, you know, grow up or are raising kids in neighborhoods where this is the case, they understand that. They understand that, and they are afraid for their children.
You know, because as you put, that's one line, that black life is cheap, but in America, black bodies are a natural resource of incomparable value.
Because it fits into the whole order. You know, it's a part of, you know, how we are and why things are the way they are. It's not so much that people want to subject black people to complete genocide. You know, black people, you know, being that below, that valley that I talk about in the book, gives everyone else meaning in the political order. It's the basis for, you know, this idea of you know, believing yourself white and believing that conveys some sort of nobility. There has to be an essential below. I was reading this book about this historian, Barbara Tishman, and she's talking about the Jewish experience in France in the 14th century. And she says if France did not have Jews, they would have invented them.
Right.
By which she does not mean, you know, right. like the Jewish religion or anything like that, but right. literally that you need somebody to occupy that below, that space. You know, it allows for the venting of, you know, inexplicable angers and frustrations and pains and all sorts of things, and gives everybody else definition.
It does give us definition. And one of the things, you make it very personal here as well when you're writing here to Samori. And you mind if I read one more thing to you? Is that right?
No, not at all. Not at all.
So towards the end of the book, you write to him directly. This is all directly to him, but I mean, we are entering our last years together, and I wish I had been softer with you. Your mother had to teach me how to love you, how to kiss you, and tell you I love you every night. Even now, it does not feel a wholly natural act so much as it feels like ritual. That's because I'm wounded. That's because I am tied to old ways, which I learned in a hard house. It was a loving house, even as it was besieged by this country, but it was hard. And in Paris, I could not shake the old ways, the instinct to watch my back at every pass and always be ready to go.
Yeah, that's the fear. I mean, that is the fear. And that's, you know, it takes from you. It's very sad. It's very, very sad. But it makes you, you know, into a certain way. It takes from you. And, you know, part of my own struggle, you know, I think with my son and I think with other things, is to try to reclaim that, you know, to try to get that back as much as possible. You know, you can never be, you know, who you think you might have been. But, you know, I've been, you know, a good part of my past 20 years or so, I've been trying to get that back. You know, and part of that is just, you know, like the ability to be tender and soft with your children. At least for me, that was part of it.
Mm-hmm. And that's something, I think that is, I guess, what you found with the woman you fell in love with in Mecca, who brought that to
you.
Yeah,
I did. I saw other people who were not like me, who had not, you know, responded in that particular way. And it very much opened up, you know, the possibility for how you could be.
And that's the other thing you wrote about, which is the Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
And what a powerful role that had. Even though you didn't graduate from Howard, it just affected you deeply.
Well, I mean, it goes back to what I was talking about, you know, like this, the part you were reading earlier about, you know, what is fashioned under the weight of the dream, and Howard University is one of those things. You know, it's this beautiful place where you see, you know, folks who hail from all different geographical, you know, positions, people who hail from all sorts of different sorts of class positions, people who look very, very different from each other, and they unite under this one idea. It is incredible. It was incredible to see, you know, people there in all their, you know, various shades of blackness. And to see the black is in and of itself a rainbow. That was mind-blowing to me.
Yeah, and I think that we all have these things in our paths that kind of open things up. And I think that the sense I get from the book, even though it's the fear is there and the struggle is there and it's not about victory, but also underlying a lot of what you're talking about is the beauty that's there. And you have to find that to survive in this madness.
That is. And, you know, and you have to take great joy from that.
Right.
You know, even if you understand like where you are, you know, even as you understand that you have to, there's something to be seen in that. You know, I mean, you know, there's reason to smile about that, even as you struggle, you know.
So has Samori read the book?
Yes, several times.
And so what is his reaction to you about the book?
I think it'll be more interesting to see his reaction in 10 years. You know, I think like right now.
He's 15?
Again, like it's very. Read little in the book that's particularly new to him.
Right.
you know, he read it in like very early draft form, read it in later draft form. So there's just little in it that's going to be, you know, completely revelatory for him. But I'm interested in what he thinks about it when he has his own parent, with his own kids, when he's a parent.
Because that's
how he'll perceive it then.
Yeah, because that does. I mean, the part when you talk about in the book when you were in New York and I forget, it was Upper East Side or Upper West Side, and you were walking with him out of a movie theater and this white woman pushed him and the confrontation ensued. I mean, that's when your responsibility, the fear and the responsibility of parenthood and the fear that you have to live with as a black man came flooding in one wave.
Right. And see, I'm very interested in how he'll perceive that when he's a parent. Yeah. You know, I think part of that too, Mark, was quite frankly, you know, we were relatively young parents. He was born when I was 24 years old, and when that happened, I might have been 28 or 29 or something like that. And so, you know, you're not that far out of the neighborhood then.
Right.
You know, and all of the old rules are still with you.
And they are. I mean, even though you make it very clear in this book and the last that you didn't walk the streets of the west side of Baltimore as a hard young man.
No, not at all.
Right? But you faced it, and you have this great quote in there about one of the things you learned you want your son to understand is you never desert your friends.
No. That's true.
So
again, but see, that goes back to the beauty, right? Even if you're talking about, you know, how hard it is there. Listen, I mean, there's some, even, you know, in these places that are tough, that are formed by fear, you know, and anger and you know, white supremacist policies, there's wisdom still there. There's wisdom, you know, that stays with you.
I do. You can't shake that. And makes me come back to thinking about Prince Jones for a moment. Just, I mean, when you meant to visit his mom, because that is a very powerful portion of the book when you sit with her.
Mm-hmm.
This woman who came from the poorest conditions, segregated conditions of Louisiana, what she made of herself as a radiologist. But just that relation, the conversation you had with her about Prince Jones and how that visit affected her. But what it's done to you, I mean, and even since then.
Well, I'm going to see her this Friday.
You are?
I'm looking forward to that. Yes, I am. Very much looking forward to that. And it was a tough conversation. It was a very, very hard conversation to have. I was grateful to her for even welcoming me in and being willing to talk about it. Here was a woman who was born into grinding poverty in Louisiana, a child of sharecroppers, who, you know, worked her way up, you know, in the bent of her own intelligence and her own labor and her own efforts. You know, went on to study medicine, served in the Navy, you know, accumulated, you know, a good bit of wealth for herself and, you know, a good life, you know, for her and her children. And basically did everything that America tells you to do, you know, about being a good citizen. And her reward from her country was the murder of her son. That is horrific. Absolutely, absolutely horrific, you know. And I think it really just, I mean, exposes the cost, you know? I mean, the possible cost, because even those of us whose kids that doesn't happen to, I mean, we live in fear. We live in fear.
And you know, when you I know it's the idea of the peace people are supposed to protect you end up killing you and they pay for nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a principle. I mean, people who you pay to protect you, in fact, people whose taxes, you know, people whose salaries are paid by your taxes, and they end up killing you, you know?
You had this one piece in here in the book about that, about the police, and I was thinking about all the conversations that I've moderated on the air and in the community about police and community, and some of my subtext always in my brain behind me is what you wrote here, which has to do with that how police reform has come into vogue. And you might talk about diversity, sensitivity, training, body cameras are all fine and applicable, but they understate the task. And you write, the truth is the police reflect America in all its will and fear. And whatever we might make of this country's criminal justice policy, it cannot be said that it was imposed by a repressive minority. So, I mean, that's the reality we have to deal with when we talk about this stuff. We don't want to talk about that.
Right. No, it doesn't exist outside of the realm of politics. You know, the police were in, you know, West Baltimore, were in, you know, Freddie Gray's neighborhood, were in Gilmore Homes because somebody decided they should be there. You know, and that somebody was not someone, you know, some unelected official sitting on high. You know, we are not, as black folks, a majority in this country. You know, there is a majority, and this is like a truly frightening thing, because I think it's much more easier to understand when you're in apartheid conditions.
Yes.
You know, and you know, there's an oppressive minority, and you can just make the straight case that, listen, the people should rule. But what happens when the people rule and they do unjust things to another minority? And that really is the situation that we're in this country, you know. That is, you know, I think hard to take, because the fact of the matter is you still have to somehow convince that majority to do the right thing. That's tough for people. That's really tough.
Right. And it's up to people who look white, whatever that means, to do that, I think.
Right. Yeah, ultimately.
Right?
Ultimately, yeah. Yes.
Right? I mean, and you bring it all the way to its zenith to me, which is the dreamer's world is so flawed that it's not just about black folks and what happens in the black world. It's what's being done to the earth and to all of us, and how we have to continue to struggle and fight and bring so much love into it at the same time to face all of that, the right reality.
Right. Right. No, I think that's exactly it. And I think ultimately, I mean, in that way, one of the things I was trying to point to ultimately is a kind of internal struggle. You know, I mean, that really is what it ultimately is about. I mean, within yourself to come to some level of consciousness of the world you live in.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, I just want to say, first of all, this I think, you know, people have said this to you, and I know it gets excited hearing it, but Between the World and Me, I think, is going to be one of those books.
Thank you. I hope so. I would be honored if that was the case.
Me too. To know that you've written this. Ta-Nehisi Coates, I want to thank you so much for the time you've given us. I know you have a very busy schedule. And Between the World and Me is a book for all of us to wrestle with and enjoy and read. And it's so well written. It's such an easy, breezy read in just the words, not in the content. Ta-Nehisi, thank you.
Thank you so much, Mark. Thank you. I'll come on your show anytime.
Thank you, Ta-Nehisi. Thanks so much.